We certainly did hire additional students, and I just had breakfast with one of them last week. He's now director of the U.S. Mint in Washington, D.C. He went from WKAR as a student announcer, where they loaned him, I mean, they said you can have some of Jay Johnson's time. And Jay didn't know anything about classical music, but all the announcers would come to me, and we would go through the lists, and almost everything was recorded. It was, very little was live. The records were spun live. We hoped by somebody who could read the record labels. And I was very proud of some of our engineers who had never done classical music, but they knew what the list was. They'd look at the, if the labels were confusing, they'd write all over the LP, and you'd send it back to me. But most of the time, the right music got played with the right announcements. Some of my students were Steve Mouchet, who today is head of radio and television, and Jay Johnson, who's now with the U.S. Mint. He went on to become an elected state representative from Wisconsin. He was at, though, much television and media from here, but now he loves his job at the U.S. Mint. He's, by the way, pushing gold dollar coins. It's his great love. Anyway, he says, I will never forget the opportunity you gave me to announce classical music on WKAR. I said, Jay, when was this? And he said, well, it was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I was very proud of what happened. Ultimately, we were able to get some additional equipment, but I left, I was also doing television here by that time, but at no expense. I mean, nobody paid me to do television, but for WKAR-TV, once they split away from the old Channel 10 liaison, so I did a lot of recital programs for Dr. Donald Pash, mostly classic stuff, and because that went out across the country, I started getting offers, and the most serious one came in 1970 from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. They had a new telecommunications building and the equipment to dream of that included both radio and television, and they had 10 satellite stations around the state of Nebraska. And I did go out to Lincoln. They flew me out. They interviewed me. They were interviewing, I don't know, two or three people. They called me up and said, we want you. I said, but you know, I'm not really a television producer. I've been talent. No, we have producers. We need people with vision. We want to do, and it seems that you would do not just classics, but you know, folk music and, you know, the people who live in Nebraska. And that did appeal to me. So I didn't really, I think I talked with WKAR, I talked with Dick Estelle, and I said, Dick, I have this offer. And I started making some arrangements to leave. And I got a call from the provost at Michigan State at that time, who said, we understand you have a job offer. This was John Cantlin. And he said, we have another job in mind for you at Michigan State, so don't accept it. Don't accept this offer. Give us a couple of days, and we'll come back to you. And so very soon, so I called Nebraska, and I said, well, there's something going on. I'm not quite sure what it is, but I need, you know, a few days. And it turned out that they had me in mind as a successor to the director of the lecture concert series, which was the presenting office at Michigan State. I was surprised to hear that because I'd been on the advisory committee for the lecture concert series as a student, and I went to a lot of events, but it didn't occur to me that my predecessor was thinking of retiring.
Is this Wilson Paul?
It was Dr. Wilson Paul, and as it turns out, he didn't know he was thinking of retiring either. So it made it very, very difficult, and what the university did is appoint me an associate for, 9 months, and gave me an office in Kellogg Center, and so we could do an orderly progression. Now, let me be very clear. The reason he was retiring from his post was that he was turning 65, and it was Michigan State's policy that administrators had to relinquish their posts 65. They could stick around and might even have office space, whatever. So I will say it wasn't really the best way to do it. It put a strain on relations with Dr. and Mrs. Paul and me for maybe 3 years total. And then we became wonderful friends. And Dr. Paul is gone, but Mrs. Paul and I are still very good friends, and we communicate several times a year. They became very big fans of mine. But really, I probably had done as much at WKAR as it was then possible to do, given our resources, both human and equipment resources. I was very proud that in, I think there have been two or three successors as music program director there, that A, they went stereo, B, they went around the clock, and they added many, you know, National Public Radio really came into the fore. I don't know if they're doing more or less original programming here than they did when I was there, but because of the services available, yeah, all of which cost lots of money, which we didn't have. I found out very soon after I came into Lecture Concert Series that the new president at that time, Dr. Clifton Wharton, felt that the University Auditorium could be replaced by something better. There had been talk on campus apparently around since the early to mid-1950s. This is when the auditorium would be 12 to 15 years old. There were people that realized that it was not suitable for all things. It was a great improvement on old gymnasia on campus, or there were performances done in what is now IM Sports Circle, Dem Hall. There's an armory that used to be before Dem Hall that, you know, traditionally, yeah, because professional performances were recorded as having taken place on this campus from the year 1912. Mm-hmm. So there was a long history, and yeah, this is all written in the, we have a first 75 years history published, which I'd be very happy to share with you. Archives has it. Mm-hmm. Okay, so it became very clear that one of the reasons they picked a youngish kind of guy, I guess I might have been around 30, with a public image because of my broadcasting,
yeah,
is that in order to do a new facility, to get a new facility here, and to convince the right people that such a facility would be feasible, because it wasn't anywhere near the list of priorities of what Michigan, yeah, State wanted to have in the early 1970s. They wanted a soil science building. They wanted additional additions to the plant pathology, soil science, biophysics, biochemistry, the whole science complex, certainly the College of Business, the College of Engineering. All of these were way, way, way ahead. Plus, there was a need for a basketball arena and also a hockey arena when we started all of this. So I guess they picked me because they knew I would speak and maybe I could join a team of people who'd be willing to do this. But what I had to do is, you know, continue the tradition of presenting at the University Auditorium, which we did. And within my first 3 years, we had formed a team to go look at other performing arts facilities, primarily on college campuses, but some that were city and university facilities. And so we ultimately, our committee, looked at around 26 venues. And we had a wonderful committee. Our new director, our new vice president for development, Les Scott, the head of the School of Music, Jim Niblack, the chair of the Department of Theater, Frank Rutledge, a professor in the College of Business, but who was in business correspondence, and I figured a real aesthetician. She's the last person who taught business students how to write letters. They don't teach that anymore.
No.
I don't know that they teach that anyplace, but Dr. Ann Garrison, and Mrs. Wharton, Dolores Wharton. And it was, of course, this idea was a joint idea of Dr. and Mrs. Wharton. One of the things they were to say later that impressed them about Michigan State is they thought that the FM station was a very credible fine arts station,
oh,
for a campus like this. And in a way, it reminded me, because it was the most important thing in my life, coming up with that new format. It took the most creative energy, even more, I would say, at the time, than planning the big hoo-ha that became Wharton Center, but wasn't called that until it was under construction. But obviously, we were very grateful to the Whartons for placing the project in the way of all of the other priorities. So it became something that many people on campus wanted to get out of the way, get it done, get it built, get it so we can go on and do what we want to do. Mm-hmm. And that's what's happening still today. It's,
yeah,
all coming in. It went through a lot of different lives. a lot of different design plans. What you see at Wharton Center today is not the facility, anywhere near the facility that was initially designed. It is not sitting where it was supposed to be placed, the footprint, even on the real estate that it's on. And of course, most of the science people didn't want a Wharton Center in their neighborhood. And the School of Veterinary Medicine most assuredly did not want it there.
Well, they can't move over there then, can they? I mean,
see, they saw it as land that was for expansion.
Right.
And it was one of nine sites that were selected. Dr. Wharton ultimately made the choice of the site.
Where were some of the others?
Some of the others were, my very favorite, and one that Mrs. Wharton liked a lot. They knew that they had to redevelop the intersection of Farm Lane and Shaw Lane.
Mm-hmm.
We see some of this going on now, and that the old pavilion would come down.
Mm-hmm.
And so they thought what they would do is make that a very big traffic circle from the moment you get south of the Farm Lane Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
It was going to go into this great traffic roundabout, and in the middle of it, they were going to build a round performing arts center and build it up in the air, so it would go up maybe five or six stories, and it would look very much like Grady Gamage Auditorium at Arizona State University. The circle would be so big that it also would contain parking and tunnels and a lot of stairways going up, because you couldn't actually go into the lobby until the second or third level. And that was one very, very innovative idea. I thought it was a horrible idea, and that it was really in the way of traffic rather than mm-hmm. complementing. But, you know, you keep hearing, I just went to a meeting 2 days ago about the future of Michigan State, 20 years, and where things are going to be located. And everybody says, well, we want this to be a pedestrian-friendly, vehicle-available place, and with lots of green space, and where cars aren't running over our students like they do on Grand River Avenue. You know, but everybody wants that, but the designs they come up with are awful. Well, six of the designs were right next to one of the railroad tracks that crosses the campus. I've talked for the city of Lansing about this. They want to put a new performing arts space right next to the downtown railroad tracks.
Oh, is that where they want to put it?
Yeah, it's actually further east than the baseball stadium. And, you know, the trains go through by Clara's and, all the time. But you see, at Michigan State, even though we ended up with this site bordered by Shaw Lane and Bogue Street, the railroad tracks are a block away, but they said, well, for the big concert hall, we're going to turn it so its back actually faces Owen Graduate Dorm, and it will be sealed off from any ambient noise of the railroad train.
Mm-hmm.
The truth of the matter is, since they moved it down across, before they started construction, and they did it like in a month before they started construction, they moved it down to the other end of the block, put the long curtain brick wall against facing the Vet Med, and so trains going by behind Vet Med all can be heard, and the train whistles mm-hmm. over on house right of the Great Hall. It never should have happened.
It bounces off, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. It's a great acoustical chamber.
Yeah.
So, but anyway, so there are little nitpicky things, but I will say my career at Michigan State and my feeling that I'm still giving back for all I got, because here I was, a kid that didn't plan to go to college. I did not take college prep, and a year after I was here, I was considered an intellectual in the Honors College and and a student leader. And because I was a student leader, I was president of the men's senior men's honorary Excalibur. I was in student government. See, I wasn't doing shows, so I did this other. They brought out student leaders all the time for university functions. So Dr. Gordon Sabine, Mr. Jim Jennison, and Dr. John Hanna. I mean, I was doing a gig a week for something, recruiting students, thanking alumni, donor, potential donors. They weren't doing a lot with donations, but they did for the Ralph Young Fund.
Yes.
Because athletics had their fundraising already going. So they bring this out. One time, I like today, I had a cold, and I was supposed to go to the Union Building and stand in a block S in my blazer with my Excalibur.
Mm-hmm.
At about 4 o'clock, I called Dr. Sabine's office and I said, I'm really miserable. I'm just going to go to bed. I've got a test in the morning. So I lay down, the phone rings, it's Dr. Sabine. He says, I don't care how you feel, put on that blazer, get over to the union, stand in the block S, you don't need to stay for dinner, you can go home and go to bed, but you gotta be here. And so I went. There's no question, right? So, but then it was Dr. John Hanna. When, and of course, Dr. Hanna was succeeded by Clifton Wharton, but in between, we had...
All those guys.
Yeah, we had Pauline and
Walter
Adams. And Walter was a, you know, a great public figure on our campus, and while I didn't have any real relationship with him, I was at WKAR at that time. When Dr. Wharton came in, I still was at WKAR. I began to work more closely. We planned not only architecture, but possible fundraising projects like an initial kickoff concert, which turned out to be Tony and Lena Singh in April of 1975. We had a design for the Performing Arts Center in late 1974. We raised money, We were to raise $12 million of the $17 million enrichment program, which as a SOP was to also benefit three other programs. For people who said, oh, I don't want to give to Performing Arts, I'd never come, I'd never use it. Most of those people that said that ultimately had kids performing at Wharton Center or had other reasons. They came to hear the Barbershoppers or the Lansing Symphony. The people who were, I can only think of one couple that made good on their word. They made sure they never came to Wharton Center. And they sat in the front row at the lecture concert series at the auditorium. And when this new place opened, they never entered it. And I knew it was because they sat in the front row in the university auditorium, and everybody knew they were there.
I know, because you certainly couldn't hear anything in the university.
So anyway, but Dr. Wharton, then to our horror, Dr. Wharton announces that he's going to State University of New York to be chancellor of the system, and I thought, the gig is up. And then Dr. Hardin, who replaced him first as acting president, called me the first day he was in office. He said, come over tomorrow afternoon at 4. He had been co-chair of the Mid-Michigan fundraising effort for our facilities, along with Mrs. Howard Stoddard, Jenny. He said, come over tomorrow afternoon at 4. We've got to come up with a plan to finish this. I'm going to tell you what I think about it. You tell me what you can do. And I was heartened, and I was over in his office the next day. And he said, I'm going to pull in Dr. Hanna. He's around, and we'll raise the rest of the money and get this thing out of the way so that the university can get on with the other projects that are important. So that was his strategy. I have to say today, as I've said for years, without Dr. Edgar Hardin, there would be no Performing Arts Center there, regardless of what it was named, because he just had a commitment to it. By the time it was in the, what was now named Wharton Center, it was the State Center for Performing Arts. And people complained that it sounded like it was in a Soviet republic. You know, just located on South Campus, the State Center for Performing Arts, and we got the State Russian Orchestra. So anyway, Dr. Hardin had been succeeded by Dr. Cecil Mackey. And in one of my first encounters with Dr. Mackey, he made it very clear to me. He said, you know, Michigan State can't afford this Performing Arts Center. He said, I am supposed to look very objectively at all the programs and things. And he said, I want you to understand that Mrs. Mackey and I are great supporters of the arts.
Oh, they were.
But as a university activity, I have to say this is at the bottom of my priorities. And if there were some way, I know it's under construction, and he says, I've checked with different people, and there's no way that they could just finish the construction and then put it on ice and open it maybe a couple years later when the economy was better, whatever. So he said, you must know that the project doesn't have my wholehearted support. So then I heard, and one of the things we had done is we'd moved the reporting line a couple of different times, of the, what was lecture concert series. We'd moved it out of lifelong education, continuing education, over to arts and letters. At this point, it still was in arts and letters, and the dean of arts and letters called me, and he said, I guess it's time we're going to post the position See, the question was how it was going to be run.
Yeah.
They didn't ever want to deal with that. Like, they didn't ever want to deal with where are people going to park? Because they didn't want to build a parking ramp.
Was it Sullivan? Was Sullivan the deal?
Yeah. No.
So
he had been succeeded by
Hollingsworth.
By Alan Hollingsworth.
Yeah.
And so they brought in two consultants to look at the project, one from University of Illinois, one from University of Iowa, and they said, no, you have to have a managing department for a building like this, because, you know, with the auditorium, classroom assignment did the space. I mean, for lecture concert series and commencement. And
oh, really?
Grounds did all the setup. Physical plant through custodial services. Actually, custodial services pretty much ran the building. Mm-hmm. It's not that I didn't like them. It's just that there were, and there was really no parking to really think about over at the auditorium. People parked wherever they could find. And there weren't any gated lots. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I got a call from Dr. Hollingsworth. He said, well, the consultants have made their recommendations, and we are going to have an administrator for a department. And so we're going to post the job nationally, and if you'd like to apply, you're more than welcome. I want to point out, I never had actually applied for a job. I was brought here by a friend when a couple months before I was a student to audition at WKAR, which in a way was applying for a job. I was offered to start right away, and ever after that, going to WSWM, coming back to WKAR as music program director, being tapped for what was director of lecture concert series, I'd never applied for any of these jobs.
Right. So they came to you.
They came to me, mm-hmm. and the university pretty much said, this is what we... So
it must have been a wonderful feeling.
It was. So all of a sudden I was faced with applying for a job. But I was also involved in getting the job description together. But you have to do research, and you know, I didn't do that myself. So I did apply for it. I also was well aware, because of the 26 places we had visited, and because my associations of concert managers and presenters, both this is the people who run Carnegie Hall and Kennedy Center and the series at the auditorium in Chicago, and that was one group, and the other was colleges and universities, that almost... I think no one who had ever been in a project planning new facilities had ever been chosen to run it. Mm. They either had heart attacks and died, they were fired, but they were never chosen. So I was well aware it would be odds on if I were selected. And then I got a call. I did apply, and I got another call from Dean Hollingsworth, and he said, well, three people from our college have applied for the position, and I wonder, will you do me a draft letter endorsing all three for my signature, please? So I wrote a letter recommending on his behalf Dr. John Baldwin, Mr. Dennis Burke from the School of Music, and Mr. Kenneth Beechler from the Lecture Concert Series, all of equal abilities, but with subspecialties in that, for the dean's signature. And I thought, I think he's just really torturing me. But a few years later, I was sent a copy of the letter, which I wrote for his signature, and there it was, speaking very highly of all three of us. I guess I didn't do the job that I should have for John and Dennis, but it was kind of, it was a sort of bittersweet. One of the things Dr. Mackey didn't tell me this, one of his assistants did say that Dr. Mackey was hopeful that they would bring in somebody from outside because he wanted to make sure that his own people were in charge. So Dr. Mackey doesn't find you his first choice. Now, this is very strange because Cecil and Claire Mackey and I have been very good friends, and would I trust them? Yes, I would trust them. But it's the politics, it's the time of when these happen. Also, it's how you perceive it. And I've always felt that if you feel it's the right thing to do, even though it may be wrong, I mean, it may not put you in the best light, you have to go with what you think is the right thing to do. And I feel that's been my relationship with Dr. Mackey, and certainly with his successor, John DiBiagio, who I have to say was a delight. And as much as Dr. Mackey was in the Great Hall at the Wharton Center the day that he announced that he was leaving as president. We had a pianist that night, and I thought, I'm sure Claire and Cecil Mackey will be in their seats, and indeed they were. And people, you know, he wasn't warmly admired on campus, but he did do the job he was supposed to do, all except for he couldn't help but open Wharton Center, and nobody took more of an interest in it. But John DiBiagio, especially a little while after he was here and he found himself a single man, was with us every night. He loved it, and he said, Ken, this Empire Brass Quintet, he says, get them here in residence. I thought, you don't understand. You've got to work through the School of Music, and we're doing it like we did the Juilliard Quartet.
Yeah.
And and the Juilliard, of course, that was a wonderful combination of Dean Richard Sullivan and the School of Music, and Dr. Niblock.
Well, Cecil Mackey, you know, came to all the theater things, and he was the only president that ever did.
Yeah.
He even went to the arena, and he went to the outdoor theater, you know.
Right. Dr. Hanna went to the touring Broadway productions in the auditorium, just as Governor William Milliken did. As a matter of fact, Wharton Center opened by the time Governor Blanchard was in, but he came to the musicals as well. Some governors come and some don't. Some presidents do and some don't. But Dr. Hanna did. Of course, with the dedication of Wharton Center, and in its first month, we had something like 5 symphony orchestras. And I'm sure John Hanna thought, aren't they ever going to do anything but symphony orchestras? Because I knew he... And by the way, we developed a very cordial, close relationship in his last years. Because I wanted to record the remarks he made at the groundbreaking. He said things about the importance of the performing arts to students and people on campus and people in the community that I had never heard him say before, and he wasn't using a script. To John Hanna, he felt that his obligation to arts and culture had pretty much been met by opening Oakland University, which was an MSU satellite campus, in an area of wealth and culture, with the Meadowbrook Music Festival, the Meadowbrook School of Music, the Meadowbrook Theater. And, you know, I felt that too, but I thought, that means Michigan State. I mean, we have so many other things we're known for. I think today, though, Wharton Center is one of the things we're known for, one of the many good things. It's a great facility. I mean, where else? I didn't bring Phantom of the Opera because I didn't want to make enemies of the School of Music, the theater department, the commencement committee, because the 11 weeks it was there.
It tied up everything,
but it set records, and as the State Journal kept pointing out, the grosses at Wharton Center for Phantom of the Opera, $1 million a week, exceed anything it's ever done before anywhere, because the Broadway theaters are smaller. So anyway, but the great thing is working with all the presidents over the years. And I was gone by the time Peter McPherson got here, but it's strange. We have probably worked 3 or 4 dedication ceremonies. I'm a member of the Armed Forces alumni, and we did the new flagpole, lighted flagpole in front of the alumni chapel. And so I'm MC in uniform, and Peter McPherson is our keynote speaker. And we worked a couple of other gigs, benefit for Kresge Art Museum, also worked with them. And and also the rededication of the Honors College building. So I have very cordial relationships with, I'm not sure he knows who I am, but he knows I was somebody who's been around here a long time. Plus, we were both in school at the same time. I just never met him. He was at he graduated in 63 from Michigan State when I did.
So you continued your reserve commitment to the military?
Well, yes.
How did that change?
To my amazement, after I graduated from Michigan State and came back to WKAR as music program director, 2 naval people in the guise of 2 university professors came to see me. They were Roland Baker, a director of the museum, and Maynard Miller, who had climbed Mount Everest, and he was a geologist here in our natural science department. I knew them because they came to WKR and did interviews and all of that, but they also were reserve science research officers, and they said, we have a little unit, a reserve unit, that meets here on campus, and we have a slot for a public affairs officer. We got out the qualifications, and you meet all the qualifications. You have A, prior military experience. You have B, a college degree, and C, you're in media. And we'd like to nominate you for a direct commission as a naval public affairs officer. And I said, oh, thank you very much. But I really felt, you know, I have my honorable discharge. I didn't really, only one summer did I have to go to Grayling and do 2 weeks with the Army. I had a ball, because I loved my 2 years with the Army. And I owed the Army the fact that I came to Michigan State. But anyway, I said, no, thank you, no, thank you. And they would call me up and say, you know, we've got some more material. No, thank you. Well, why don't you come to one of our drills? And so I did, and they had fascinating speakers. They had Milton Rokeach talking about leadership psychology, and lots of, they weren't all science either. And I really liked them. So I gave in and sent in some papers, and the Navy sent me some more papers, and I sent those in. This went on 9 months, and all of a sudden I get a call that I'm to report for my direct commissioning ceremony in Detroit at the Naval Recruiting Headquarters in Detroit, and thinking that I'd be commissioned and then come back here and be part of the, it was a Office of Naval Research Reserve Unit on campus.